Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Frula, representing the petitioners here today, which include a wide range of businesses in the motor freight transport industry, from small business trucking companies to major publicly traded logistics corporations. Our focus today is on an innocuously titled document called Resources for Safety Stakeholders, which the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration published online on May 16, 2012. While may it sound innocuous, make no mistake, that release was a watershed event because it repurposed the agency's safety measurement system from an enforcement triage tool to an integral part of what the public must consider to determine whether a motor carrier is safe. And in so doing, it fundamentally reordered the agency's pre-existing rating system safety fitness determination set forth in 49 CFR Part 385 that was before this court in 1997 in the MST Express case, again, for failure to comply with notice and comment procedures. So there is a bit of recidivism going on here. And what our standing declarations show is that this release changed the world for millions of businesses, including motor carriers, freight brokers and forwarders, insurance banks, insurance companies, banks, and even plaintiffs' attorneys.
Can we start with the jurisdictional question? Sure. Under the Hobbs Act, this has to be a rule, a regulation, or a final order, correct?
It's a rule.
Okay, and your view is it's a legislative rule, is that
it's
right?
It's a legislative rule.
Okay. So, and that's the basis of jurisdiction here?
That's the basis of jurisdiction over the procedural claims, yes.
What other claims are there besides those?
There was a claim that this is agency action, this arbitrary and capricious.
Well, it still has to be a rule, regulation, or a final order, right? Before we can hear it at all, the only thing we have jurisdiction over are rules, regulations, or final orders. I'm right about that.
Right, but a rule can be a rule without being a legislative rule.
Ah, okay. So you think it's an interpretive rule?
No, what I'm saying is that it can be a rule for purposes of arbitrary and capricious review, separate and independent from the issue of notice and comment rulemaking, though we've considerably focused on the procedural elements here, because that's really the threshold.
Right. So the question I have is, do we have jurisdiction? Hobbs Act says rules, regulations, or final orders. You say it's a rule, and I ask you what kind of rule, and you say it's a legislative rule. Now, is there some other kind of rule that it's also besides a legislative rule?
While you're answering Judge Garland's question,
yes,
kind of focus on what it is that is safe. PowerPoint or the original SMS?
The PowerPoint. And what the PowerPoint says that's critical here is it says, for the first time, that an examination of a motor carrier's official safety rating in SAFER and their authority and insurance status on the licensing and insurance database, which I'll come back to, combined with their intervention prioritization status in CSA's SMS safety management system, provides shippers with an informed, current, and comprehensive picture of a motor carrier's safety and compliance standard. That's something that this agency had never said before.
So it may be something new, we'll hold that for a moment, but to be a legislative rule, we've held it has to bind a private party or an agency with the force of law. Now that statement doesn't bind anybody. It just announces the government's view on that question, I guess.
Well, I direct the court's attention to the Chamber of Commerce versus Department of Labor case, because what you have here is leveraging agency resources in the era of sequester. In that case, the OSHA had
you think this is a response to sequester? That's what
I think it's something that you'll see more and more. That's why this case ought to be interesting to you, because you're going to see more and more agencies leveraging.
It's always interesting to us.
This is why it matters.
We have to hear the appeals whether they're interesting or not.
Okay. Granted, that's your job.
But we've said in cement kiln, we said in a dozen cases that it has to bind a private party or an agency with the force of law to be a legislative rule. And I'm not saying who this binds here.
I'd like to focus the court's attention on the Chamber of Commerce versus Department of Labor case. It's an OSHA case. I think it was 108 F3rd, if I'm not mistaken. In that case, employers were given the option to undertake essentially an Uber compliance program and through that avoid an OSHA audit, a specific OSHA inspection that everybody dreads. The court there said, doesn't matter that you're not required, that you're not required to do this Uber special, your own compliance plan, but it's still a rule because you're influencing private interests in a significant way. And this is the exact same thing that's going on here. What this agency is saying to the freight brokers and shippers and to the carriers themselves is, look, we have this safety fitness determination standard that requires boots on the ground, that's decades old, that we can't possibly administer. We can't possibly go to the 500,000 carriers and conduct an audit. Maybe it's as many as 750,000. So what we're going to do is we're going to create this separate system online called the safety management system. We're going to create a separate, whole separate evaluation system and a whole separate website, okay, from the official system. And now what they're saying is you got to look at both of them. And what that's doing in practical effect in the regulated community is all of a sudden these golden triangles.
You said you've got two. You said the agency said you've got it. But in announcing the SMS originally, it said provide the motor carrier industry and other safety stakeholders a more comprehensive, informative, and regularly updated safety performance data. And actually, also promises to update your public website. So I still don't see what the PowerPoint added.
What it's saying to the shipping and brokering community is you're on your own in terms of evaluating the safety of these motor carriers, that you need to look at our official system and our safety management system both. And that there's no objective place. There's no objective place that you can go and determine whether a carrier is safe. It's up to you.
Well, then why did the original statement of the Federal Register about the SMS say the same thing? SMS would provide the motor carrier industry and other safety stakeholders more comprehensive, informative, regularly updated safety performance data.
I'd like to compare the entire release to that statement, which was announcing that we've created this database. Why don't you go take a look at your scores and see how you did and get back to us? Compared to the shipper addendum, which basically says a series of things. First, it announces that it has this safer SIS standard that involves your official safety fitness determination and the licensing and insurance. You have that, and then the agency goes ahead in the release for the first time in May and says, that's really not very good. It says it's not current, and it's a snapshot in time of when we audited. And then it goes on to extol the virtues of the safety measurement system in glowing terms, and then says, for the first time, if you want to get a picture, if you want to get a true picture.
But Judge Williams' question is, didn't it the original announcement say that they were going to prioritize inspections based on this?
Prioritizing inspections is one thing. If it was just prioritizing inspections, we wouldn't be here.
Well, then what is it that puts this under what you described as Chamber of Commerce, which I'm going to discuss with you intensely in a moment?
Yes.
Because it's in a footnote only in your brief and not mentioned anywhere else and not discussed in any way. But assuming Chamber of Commerce stands for the proposition you say, which is directing enforcement priority stands for legislative rule, why isn't Judge Williams right? Well, in that respect, this is you're out of time because that was raised originally. How is it different?
What is happening here, and it's the same thing that was happening in Chamber of Commerce case, is the agency is...
How is it different than what was done in, I think, 2010?
Yeah.
2010 did not say, essentially, that if you want, we leave you alone. We're denigrating our own existing system that provides an objective standard.
I don't see the denigration.
If it says it's only a snapshot in time.
I just don't see the denigration here, page 153. Where is the
It's for earlier on the shipper addendum, and the first six or seven pages of it, it talks about this existing system being a snapshot in time, being something that may be many years old, but if you want to get a current, clear, comprehensive picture of a carrier, you need to look at our whole other new database.
Okay. And the original announcement in 2010 spoke of more comprehensive, informative, regularly updated safety performance data.
But it didn't go so far as to say to the industry, you're on your own in trying to unscramble what this SMS system means, that you need to rely on your own business judgment in assessing.
It said, here is data useful for safety stakeholders through the different time.
But it proceeds to characterize it in a way that it's never characterized it before. It proceeds to accord it some official sanction that just didn't exist before.
Sorry,
you can look at the... Another Federal Register notice, one that came out on March 27, 2012, right before, it talks about the implication is this is data that's interesting and good to use and might be informative. But then when you look at the administrative record, what you see and what the agency pulled together to be the administrative record in this case is sort of this crescendo of concern from the regulated community, from insurers, from shippers, that all of a sudden, the shippers better be careful to work with the carriers so that nobody gets out of service by waiting to load cargo too long. There's all this tumult. There's all this concern. And what the agency then goes on and says is this is actually probably a pretty good thing, because what it does is we can say that we can't go out and do safety fitness determinations for everybody, but we can say that everybody's got to be concerned about these golden triangles. And if they're concerned about the golden triangles, then they're going to conform their behavior, and they're going to do more to be safer than would necessarily happen if the world were simply relying on this old official Part 385 safety fitness determination. Why I'm submitting to you today, as I slept on it and thought about it for a while, that the Chamber of Commerce case is so important, is because really OSHA's got the same problem that this agency does. There's a bazillion companies OSHA needs to regulate.
So I'm right. I always hate it when I think I've forgotten some case that I've intensely read. But it turns out I haven't intensely read this case, because it's only cited in a footnote, right? It's not discussed in any way.
It's cited in a footnote.
Right.
And I'm trying to figure out a way to sum this up for you.
I understand. But now I have read it through the miracle of Westlaw. And that's a case where the agency held that where the agency required the OSHA regulated entities to choose between adopting this comprehensive safety program or submitting to agency inspection. There's no requirement here one way or the other with respect. There's no legal obligation imposed on the trucking companies here. Is that right?
The obligation comes from a different place here.
There's
a legal obligation.
It doesn't come from the agency. It doesn't come from the federal government.
It comes from – the obligation comes from the liability pressures that they're facing when –
That was not the Department of Labor case, right? That's not the case you cited. That's not in that case.
In that instance, you had a choice. You either could do the voluntary compliance program or they could audit you. But there was no requirement that there's no requirement that you do either one.
You were required to do a program in order to avoid the audit. There's nothing like that here, one way or the other. There's no program here for you to be a part of. They analyze a bunch of data, they manipulate it, and they decide whether to prioritize an investigation. But there's no program that you have a choice about becoming a part of.
Well, it is part of the program. It is part of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration's Part 385 safety and fitness program, because it's been added to it. What we talk about amending a legislative rule, you're amending by adding. You're adding this entire new rubric to your safety fitness determination. You're saying we're bringing this into the mix. This is something that everybody needs to consider now that they didn't have to consider before, and they're doing it without notice and comment rulemaking. And that's the issue. Because what they're saying is this does have official sanction now, even though it didn't before May 16th. That's the point we're making.
That's a different question than the way in which it becomes asserting the power of law over the private party or the agency itself. It may be new, but that doesn't mean it's a new legislative rule.
But under American Mining Congress, a legislative rule can amount to an amendment, an amendment to an agency action amending a legislative rule that was created by virtue of a law that requires a rulemaking itself amounts to a legislative rule.
If it imposes obligations on the agency itself in terms of having to follow it in the future or in terms of a private party, but this doesn't seem to do that.
Well, the point is the agency imposed the obligations that it had, that it could. What it did, again, we have to step back because there's a half a million carriers out there, and the agency can't possibly begin to, as they admit, and I think anybody would concede, audit everybody every year. There just aren't the people.
I understand so that, but that, they said in 75 Federal Register in 2010, they said that they were going to use SMS to, quote, identify high risk and other motor carriers for on-site compliance reviews.
Right. That's their compliance reviews. That's not what we're talking about here.
What are you talking about?
We're talking about the public. When the public picks a motor carrier, when a shipper or a broker picks a carrier.
You're saying that by putting, so this is totally, completely different than the Chamber of Commerce case, right?
Well,
that was nothing about what the public would evaluate. That was about what DOL would decide. It's enforcement review.
Well, what I was saying about the Chamber of Commerce case is that it's the identical issue is how you leverage scarce agency resources, and again, that was a sequester point. How you leverage scarce agency resources when you have millions upon millions or hundreds of thousands of entities to regulate and not enough people to do it.
Right, but those cases, to the extent there are any cases about prioritizing enforcement, almost all of which go the opposite way, they are the agency's enforcement, and if you're right about that, that the agency's enforcement is a enforcement prioritization is a rule. Judge Williams' question is, wasn't it already a rule in 2010?
But what I'm saying is it's not the agency's the agency's enforcement prioritization tool is being repurposed. It's not at this stage being used for the agency to decide who to investigate further. It's for the public.
And there
was a case back then, and the case was resolved with a disclaimer, and the disclaimer that went up on the website said nothing about the public being required to use the SMS system.
Nothing new has said that the public is required. The public is told in the PowerPoint there's this information out there that is really useful on the question of safety.
It goes beyond, respectfully, it goes beyond really useful. Informed, current, and comprehensive picture of a motor carrier's safety and compliance standing. But you need to couple that with the other statements that are made, which is if you want to evaluate the safety and compliance standing of a motor carrier, you're going to have to do that based on your own business judgment. You can't look to anything, any stamp of approval from us. You can't look to an objective standard that was created pursuant to 49 CFR Part 385 that was objective, that was national, that wasn't relative, where you could point to it. And in MST Express, one of the points that this court made about the Part 385 test was its role in informing the public. It called it significant. Its role in informing the public was significant. What this agency puts out, how it informs the public, that's one of the purposes that Congress cares about here. It's one thing to get the trucks on the road, yes. The other is to make sure that the public has full and accurate, the best information it can so they can make their choices. And what is the leverage point here? It's a little different, granted, than the Chamber of Commerce case. The leverage point here is that a shipper or broker who hires a carrier, its worst nightmare is to get dragged into a state court case, into a tort case, vicariously liable because the shipper got into an accident. That's their leverage point here. That's a unique leverage point. I can't tell you that there's ever been one quite like that. I know that when you looked at the airport scanner case, you were looking at significant public impacts and determining whether something is a legislative rule or not. I mean, that basically just said to the public, you know, we're using different scanners. The court will be functional in these cases, because it has to be, because agencies are going to morph and evolve. I mean, if the agency has a limited budget, they're public servants. They're not going to say, oh, I got to go home. You know, unless there's a shutdown, they're not going to say, I got to go home. What they're going to do is they're going to try to find a way to regulate the best they can. And that's what's happening here. They're using the tools. They're using the suasion points that they have. They're using. And what's happening is, all of a sudden, it's not enough to rely on the safety fitness determination. There's a whole industry out there of companies that are helping these brokers and carriers, and it's discussed in our standing addendum, helping them study to this new test of SMS. The goal is to have no golden triangles. And what's happened after May 16th, 2012, does it matter? Petitioner BP Express lost a $250,000 account in September 2012 because it had one golden triangle. Petitioner Conard Transportation's longtime liability insurer wouldn't renew its federally required coverage in late 2012 because of its SMS score.
So is the result of your argument that any time an agency has a standard and the agency subsequently makes available to the public data relating to that standard, that is necessarily a legislative rule?
No, it's not there is a standard.
So reformulate it for me so I understand why sharing updated data makes this a legislative rule.
There is a standard.
Yes.
An objective standard in Part 385 that is required to be implemented by regulation. That exists. The issue here is, there was other data that was originally designed to be used as an enforcement prioritization tool, as was explained in 2010, as was explained in the settlement and the disclaimer.
Okay. Look at JA-77 for me. And maybe there's a better page for your argument. Where is the agency saying we're no longer adhering to our standard under Part 385? We have a new standard.
I'd point the court to JA-153.
Okay. So it's identified the three sources of data.
Right.
That give you this comprehensive picture.
Right. And by statute, that's the agency's job, is to provide a credentialing standard. What they've done is they have, by virtue of how they are now for the first time repurposing and re-explaining the SMS system, they're incorporating this whole new second website into their credentialing system.
Okay, but look at, if you look at, because I had noted in JA-77 the reference to JA-153, and the first website is just to electronic records data. The second is to licensing and insurance. And the third is the SMS. Where is there a new standard?
The SMS is becoming part of the safety fitness standard. What the agency is required to do by law and by its regulations is to assess and present to the public a motor carrier safety and compliance standing with the agency. What it's doing here is it's saying It's not enough to look to look to the old system that we have. We're telling you now, we're putting you on notice, it's no longer enough. You need to look at this second database that we originally created as an enforcement prioritization tool, but now that we see what it can do in terms of driving public behavior, that's becoming part of the official standard. Again, it's an amendment by addition.
Can I ask again, though? I'm still maybe fixated, is the right word, on how this is different from 2010. And reading from the 2010 announcement, it says, by implementing the new CSMS algorithm, PHMSA will be able to better identify high-risk motor carriers, and provide the motor carrier industry and other safety stakeholders with more comprehensive information and regularly updated safety performance data. Now, how is that, which words on JA-153 is that inconsistent with? This says to provide, and on 153, an informed, current, and comprehensive safety picture. And in 2010, they said, provide the motor carrier industry, not just themselves for prioritization, but the industry, more comprehensive information. Why is it different?
Because when you look at the entire presentation and the addendum, which culminates in that discussion, what they're saying for the first time is you can't rely.
Well, when
you can't rely on our safety fitness determination to make your business decisions.
Well, why isn't that
a point of emphasis?
It's more comprehensive, informative, and regularly updated. That's more than whatever they were doing before.
Right. It's more. It's information, but it's not going to the point of saying you need to consider this, because that discussion did not include also these references to needing to exercise your own sound business judgment. That's new, because what it's saying when it starts talking about business judgment, it's keying right into this issue of vicarious liability. It's keying right into this point of suasion by saying this now is critical to your choice, your business decision, the standard of care. It's starting to use standard of care words and standard of care triggers that apply. And that's new, because you don't see
when
that.
When they talk about providing the motor carrier industry and other safety stakeholders better data, they need to use the magic word business judgment. The way in which SMS information
want to try to focus the court on the two-year span. That, in 2010, there was that statement, this preliminary statement. There was a suit by some of these petitioners that was settled. Essentially, what the settlement provided was two things. One was a disclaimer that said that this was an internal, that the SMS was an internal agency prioritization tool, and pardon me while I want to make sure I get the words right, so let me find the place where I have it written here. Readers should not draw conclusions about a carrier's overall safety condition simply based on the data displayed, and that the golden triangle is not intended to imply any federal safety rating of the carrier. So what they're saying here is basically what, at that point, the agency and DOJ thought the law meant. Because it had to be what they thought the law meant, otherwise they couldn't have settled the case for it. And so that disclaimer isn't talking in terms of something that you need to look at to determine a motor carrier's safety fitness. So you have this disclaimer as part of the settlement. You also had that golden triangle, which was what was agreed to as a way to reference when you're sort of over the, you know, in on the wrong side of the percentile curve. And then
what page in the record is the disclaimer?
The disclaimer, think it's...
I know it was in your brief, I just want to find
I think
it
it's on page 25 of the addendum. If not, I'll have somebody pass me a note. Yeah, there it is. It's on page 25. It's on Joint Appendix 150.
150?
150.
This is under what are the limitations of SMS?
Yes.
Is that what you mean? And is that not part of the presentation still?
It's part of the presentation still, but it's just, the disclaimer has essentially been obviated by the way the overall release is characterizing this SMS
but
system.
But the page that you cited, that's part of the...
That is part of it.
So the disclaimer is still there?
It is. But in Appalachian Power, there was a disclaimer there, too, and the court said, you know, at some point a disclaimer can just become eyewash.
But this is a disclaimer you asked for.
Right. It's a disclaimer that we asked for. But what the concern is that now, all of a sudden, these SMS scores are being part of what's intended to imply a federal safety rating, because you can't evaluate the safety fitness of a motor carrier without looking at it. When that disclaimer sort of lands in the middle of the rest of this discussion, it's vitiated.
Your argument then is that the statements, page 153, trump and repudiate the statements, page 150.
That's why our clients brought this petition for review. The disclaimer is a fair statement of the law, and we've now gone beyond that statement of the law. That's the issue here. Those two provisions don't match up.
Is 153 the best case for you?
153 is the best case.
That's the best case. Okay. And just to get this, the timing of the with respect to the Hobbs Act correct, there's nothing. You do have to have raised this point within 120 days.
60 days of the release, which we did.
You're only arguing from the release.
Then. Well, we're arguing from the release, but there is case law under the Hobbs Act that the release can open up the prior.
Well, now you're talking about the reopener doctrine.
Right, but I'm saying so that it is. We're talking about the release, but. It brings with it the SMS. But, yes, the release is the principal point of the court's jurisdiction. Yes.
But the reopener doctrine, we've said many times, requires the circumstance where the agency invites new comment on reconsidering an old rule and indicates that it will reconsider the old rule. That's the opposite of what you're claiming.
Maybe I made a mistake in... which I always tell people not to do in a deposition, which answered the question that wasn't asked. I thought you were going to a second point of, if it's just the release, so anything else in the SMS system we can't consider at all.
Yes. Well, I am asking you that, and I thought your answer to that was, well, it's been reopened. Is that right?
It's been reopened. Yes, it's discussed fully. The SMS is discussed fully in this release. So you need to evaluate it in order to understand what's going on.
Instead of using the word release, you mean these screenshots, that's what you're talking about.
The PowerPoint.
Yes. Yes. Okay. But it could be a press release, it could be a lot of different things and be a legislative role.
But to the extent that the PowerPoint is consistent with what happened in 2010, you agree you couldn't challenge it, correct?
If it was fully consistent, but our point is that it's not, and that it's a departure, that it's a repurposing of the SMS system, that it's a recharacterization, a reallocation of roles between Part 385 and SMS.
Okay, we'll hear from the other side. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I please the Court? I'm Jeffrey Player. I'm counsel for the respondent in this matter. Your Honors, the Court is correctly focused on the question of whether the PowerPoint documents really, as petitioners say, repurpose the SMS database system that was rolled out in 2010, and whether that new agency utterance somehow gives rise to a new rule that permits the Court to assume jurisdiction, notwithstanding the 60-day limitation on petitioning for review under the Hobbs Act. As the Court has correctly noted, the agencies has encouraged the public to look at safety information available from the agency for many years preceding the release of these PowerPoint documents. Public release of safety information began in 1999. You have quoted in our brief an Inspector General report dated in 2004 noting that the agency was releasing this the type of safety information and encouraging the public to use it and making business decisions. Both your, Judge Garland and Judge Williams quoted from the April 2010 Federal Register notice, noting the intent to continue this policy and to improve it. In the prior litigation that the initial challenge to the 2010 SMS system, which was eventually settled, there were stay matters before the court. In that stay matter, the government filed a declaration from the Associate Administrator for Enforcement describing the purposes of the SMS system. That is a judicially noticeable declaration, and I'd like to quote from it briefly at page 8.
Where is that?
It's not in this record, Your Honor. It is a stay application affidavit.
And so it's nowhere before us.
It was placed before, not in this proceeding,
this
Your Honor.
This is even worse than arguing from a footnote. This is arguing from an absent footnote.
Okay, well, then I will move on to other matters, Your Honor. I think it amplifies all the points the Your Honor noted in the 2010 Federal Register notice, noting that this data had been made publicly available for some time, that it was the agency's intent in rolling out the 2010 SMS system to continue that policy of public access, to improve the kind of data that was collected, and to encourage the public to look at it in making business decisions. As Your Honor, Your Honors have noted. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What you just said, I took to be a composite of the material of page 150.
Yes, sir. I think that's a fair characterization. The idea that the PowerPoint documents in of themselves somehow amount to a radical departure from agency prior agency policy, that they announce a new rule of decision or a new standard that compels the public to look at additional safety information, that this is somehow at variance with the agency's prior practices on the disclosure of public information, simply isn't borne out by the record. The disclaimer language that Judge Garland was looking at earlier further supports that contention. This is a disclaimer provision that was negotiated as part of the settlement of the prior litigation. The disclaimer is there precisely because all the parties understood that the public would be looking at this information and making and using it to make business judgments. And all the disclaimer says is essentially that the public should consider the totality of information available to it and not make its decision on any based on any one piece of information.
So is it inaccurate to characterize the chain of events that at no point did the agency take the position that the fitness determination itself was the determinant?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand Your Honor's question.
As I understood, the argument being presented is that before the PowerPoint presentation, the agency had taken the position that a fitness determination with the SMS system that determined whether or not a motor carrier was operating safely from the agency's perspective.
The agency has continually taken the position and consistently that a safety determination, a safety fitness determination entered under the statute, determines whether the operator has the authority to operate in interstate commerce. At page 150 of the appendix, an excerpt of the PowerPoint documents challenge here, the agency reiterates that the SMS data are not a safety fitness determination, do not alter a carrier's safety rating, and do not impact a carrier's operating authority. Nothing in the SMS system and nothing in the PowerPoint documents that describe the system alter that policy in any way. The safety fitness determination entered under the statute is a different piece of information. It is issued after a full compliance review by the agency The carrier is assigned a rating. If it gets a conditional or a satisfactory rating, it is authorized to operate in interstate commerce.
I understand the authorization issue, but just in a hypothetical.
Yes, sir.
Suppose everyone is proceeding and they've received safety fitness determinations based on using tire A. Then the agency collects data showing that tire A is really dangerous and that for safety purposes, tire B is much better. And so it puts out that data. And what I hear being argued is that just changes the universe because we were proceeding under a certain set of assumptions. Now, with this new data, the world has changed. And by the agency saying, we encourage the public to use this new data about tire B, in my hypothetical, essentially the agency has changed its standard, its rule, et cetera, so that, as I understand the argument, that if your fitness determination finds that the vehicle is not using tire B, it will fail.
Well, Your Honor, I think the key point there is the agency would have to go back to the carrier, conduct a review, find that it is now using tire B, apply its new standard, and it would have to be a standard promulgated through rulemaking, and then make a new determination as to the carrier's safety fitness determination. And then from that point forward, yes, the carrier's operating authority would change. But there has to be a determination by the agency that has some legal effect and some that changes rights and privileges and so forth. That happens in the safety fitness determination process. It does not happen through the SMS system. If state law enforcement officials were to begin issuing violations to carriers, some sort of safety or maintenance violation of a state standard or a federal standard, saying you're not using those tires, the correct tires, you're using an unsafe tire, that would appear, those violations would appear in the SMS system. If you were an insurer or a shipper, you could take that into account in deciding whether to contract with the carrier. But it does not affect the carrier's operating authority. It does not have a legal effect on the carrier until the agency goes back and conducts this fitness determination and issues a new safety fitness rating. And that's really that really is at the heart of why the court doesn't have jurisdiction here. To have jurisdiction under the Hobbs Act, you have to have a rule or regulation or order.
There's two hearts to this jurisdictional question.
Yes.
One heart is the timing question.
Absolutely.
And one is the one you're launching on now.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if it were correct that SMS did have the kind of consequence that you're talking about, I take it your argument is it had that consequence starting in 2010 when it was announced.
Absolutely.
And that hasn't changed since then.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
That's absolutely our position, Your Honor. There was an opportunity to challenge the SMS system when it was rolled out in December 2010. Most of these petitioners availed themselves of that opportunity, filed a petition for review in this court. That litigation was settled. The PowerPoint documents that are now challenged here were issued months later in 2012. And the only way petitioners can get around that time bar is to attempt to persuade the court that there's something new and radical about this PowerPoint document that is some enormous departure from the prior rule. And that's just simply not borne out by the record.
Even though the world may have changed for the petitioners, the court just doesn't have jurisdiction.
Well, the world would have to have changed to a much greater degree than is present in this case before the
court. Well, don't get into that because then you have my hypothetical.
Well, again, there would have to be some new rule rather than a simply rearticulation and a further description of the prior rule to get around the time bar you're on. That, again, that simply hasn't happened here. These are PowerPoint documents. They are essentially, for the most part, they are screenshots. They're reproductions of what you see when you go into the SMS database and make an inquiry, the same thing you would have seen when the system was first introduced in 2010. It has none of the indicia of reopening the SMS system for further...
What do you mean when you say that? Were these screenshots available in 2010?
They weren't reproduced in printed form, but anyone could go into the system, and that's what would appear on the computer screen.
So this PowerPoint was available in 2010?
No, the PowerPoint was released in May of 2012, but what it displays is what the system would have displayed in 2012.
It's simply I'm still confused. So the petitioner's point is particular to JA 153.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would that have been available to somebody in 2010?
That would not, Your Honor.
It would not.
No, but the screenshots that display the system information, that would have been in 2010.
And more,
the narrative portions of the PowerPoint release, those are new, but they're describing simply what you see in the screenshots and what you might do with the information. They're not advancing any kind of new policy. Yeah.
Other questions?
All right,
thank you.
Thank you.
Time left? All right, we'll give you another 2 minutes anyway.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government's contention is basically that the world doesn't change until it promulgates a new rule. That's not the case. Otherwise, none of the cases that we've been discussing, EPIC or any of those, would have ever been decided.
My point was the world may change, but that doesn't necessarily give us jurisdiction.
But if the world changes in a way that a legislative rule has been created because of what that statement entails, then there is a legislative rule. And really, there's a safe extensions case that we cited where it wasn't Tire B, it was a different kind of airport runway light. And respectfully to the Chief Judge, we the discussion of the Chamber of Commerce case was in text. It was part of a broader discussion of the point that legislative rules implement congressional intent, that they affect statutory purposes, and that they can grant rights, impose obligations. And this is the part that we respectfully ask the court to focus on, or produce other significant effects on private interests. And it's that point there is what we focused on. We focused on page 40 with a bunch of cases. And the reason that I picked that one out was because of this leveraging point that I think is so apt.
We're going to look at the case whether it's in or not. But the point about that case is prioritization of enforcement efforts.
Right.
And you want to draw a broader effect.
I'm drawing a broader effect. Basically, what I tried to say at the start, and wasn't very good at it apparently, was that the reason you should need to care here is because of this similar leveraging of scarce agency resources and using the tools of suasion that you have to drive private behavior. And that's the point. That's the main point that I wanted to draw from Chamber of Commerce, and also that you didn't necessarily have to be a legal requirement to submit to that Uber personal alternative compliance program.
Okay. Further questions? Take the matter under submission. Thanks very much.
Thank you.